что у нас сегодня очень интересный человек в гостях, не физически в гостях, а он с нами по телефону, но вы его хорошо знаете, его зовут Билл Браудер. Билл Браудер был у нас несколько лет назад, давал нам интервью здесь на радио, и мы обсуждали закон Магнитского, который имел такие далеко идущие последствия. В тот момент никто всерьез не верил, что российские санкции против российских чиновников могут как-то что-то изменить. Но вот в данный момент это уже совершенно такая очевидная действительность, что санкции, да, вводят не только Соединенные Штаты, но и многие другие страны. Санкции, да, работают. И, в общем, Билл был тот человек, который первый начал таким образом бороться с российской коррупцией и с российским произволом. Ситуация, правда, с тех пор осложнилась, но об этом мы с ним немножко тоже поговорим. Билл написал книгу, которая называется «Red Notice». Эта книга сейчас вышла, и ее можно купить в Канаде, ее можно купить в Соединенных Штатах Америки. И я надеюсь, что это будет очень интересная книга, которая попадет на лист бестселлеров. Но мы подробности спросим у Билла самого, он сейчас у нас в эфире. Hi, Билл!
Hi there.
You just got back from U.S. tour, right? From U.S. book tour.
I was just in the U.S. for 10 days launching Red Notice. I'm now in the U.K. Doing the same thing and then on to a number of countries in Europe where it's being published in more than 10 languages.
So how is the book doing?
The book is doing very well. New York Times bestseller list, we're number 11 on the New York Times list in the United States in nonfiction, and I was just looking on Amazon Canada yesterday, and we're in the top 10 on Amazon Canada as well. So this is I intended this book for a large audience. I wanted a lot of people, not just Russian experts, to read this, and so far, at least in the first 10 days or so, it looks like we've succeeded.
It's actually much easier read that one would expect from such a serious subject. So I'm sure it's going to be a successful book. And it's also warmer, because I personally didn't expect to find there some details of your life, like you telling the story about being in love with your wife and how it happened. I didn't expect to find it there. So I think it would be interesting, not just for people who want Russian corruption story. It's just a story of a man who is on a certain path. So I guess it's gonna do well in every circle.
Well, the important thing for me is, I mean, I have a mission here, which is I want people to know what happened to Sergei Magnitsky, but I don't have to make it unpleasant for them to learn this story. I want there's a lot of interesting things and also pleasant things in the story, not just the tragedy. And as is all true and generally in life. And the more human you can make a story, and the more open you can make the story, the more people want to read it.
So our listeners are, they know short version of a story, but I want you to tell us again, at one point you were ally of Vladimir Putin because you thought he was fighting Russian corruption. And only later you discovered that he wasn't fighting it. He just wanted a chunk of the proceeds. So how did this happen, and how did you discover it?
Well, so I went to Russia originally after the Soviet Union ended and the privatization program began, to be an investor. I started investing. I set up an investment fund to invest in the shares of Russian companies. My investment fund grew quite large. And then I discovered that a lot of the companies that I was investing in were being robbed by the corrupt oligarchs, and this was back in the mid to late 1990s. And so you had these 22 oligarchs who had basically stolen these huge companies from the state, and then they're running the companies in such a corrupt way that they were stealing from the other shareholders. And I felt both a financial duty to my investors and also a moral duty to fight the corruption. I started to research how the corruption was being done. I then exposed the corruption through the international media. And for about 4 years, from when Putin came into office until late 2003, he was what I would call an unwitting ally in my fight against corruption for a very strange reason. So I was exposing the oligarchs because they were stealing money from me. And he was very upset with the same oligarchs because they were stealing power from him, because the presidency of Russia had been degraded by the time he got there. And so for a number of years, he would help, and I never met this man, I never had any contact with him, but when I would create a scandal, he would step into the scandal and do various things which were helpful to me. And so for a while, I thought that I was, and naive, I guess, to say this, but I thought that he was interested in fighting corruption. But then something happened which changed everything, which was at the end of 2003, he arrested the richest man in Russia, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and he put him on trial in 2004. And when they held the trial, they allowed the television cameras in to film Khodorkovsky, who was the richest, most powerful man in Russia, sitting in a cage. And this had the most powerful psychological effect on the rest of the oligarchs in Russia, because they all sat there and said to themselves, my God, we don't want to sit in a cage. And so they all went back to the Kremlin and said, Vladimir Vladimirovich, what do we have to do to make sure we don't sit in a cage? And his answer was 50%. And from that moment on, he became the richest oligarch in Russia, and my interests then became no longer helpful to him as I was exposing corruption, but harmful to him economically.
Is there a way to trace those 50%?
Well, there's no ways to trace it, in most of it, for one simple reason, because he doesn't hold it in his own name. He has these people, these oligarchs, continue to hold all the assets in their name, but they're trustees for him. And so some of this has already been articulated. For example, when the U.S. imposed sanctions, they named some of these oligarchs and even discussed how they held money for Vladimir Putin. We've also seen some examples. I'm sure many of the listeners here will remember the story of Putin's Black Sea Palace. There was this building, maybe building is probably too small a word for it, a billion-dollar construction site near Sochi, where Putin has a house. And one of the people who was involved in this was run out of the country, and then he disclosed all the documents, which shows that a bunch of oligarchs contributed money to some kind of medical equipment fund, which wasn't spent on medical equipment, but then spent on Putin's house. And so this is one example where one can see actually the sort of exact way in which it happened.
But do you think U.S. financial institutions, do you think if we wanted to, we could have traced some of the money at least?
Well, I'm sure they can. And I mean, the thing about money is that it leaves a permanent trail. Unless you carry cash, and the amounts of money that we're talking about are so large that nobody could ever carry around hundreds of millions of dollars of cash, it always leaves a trail from one institution to the next to the next. And so this money will always be traceable now and into the future. And this is one of Putin's big fears, is that unlike Stalin or various other former dictators, Putin he's got a big Achilles heel, and his Achilles heel is that while he's doing terrible things at home, he likes to keep money in the West, and that is the one place where we really do have leverage over him. And I do think that the Western politicians haven't woken up properly to this fact. They're all sort of sitting there with old constructs in their mind about how one deals with Putin. But the way you deal with him is to deal with his money.
In a book, you're writing that after Sergei Magnitsky was killed in jail, you discovered that you thought Katyn principle, Russia was beyond Katyn principle and its mass state-sponsored lying, but you discovered it is not, and now we all discovered it with what's happening in Ukraine. So we're all basically fighting this mass state-sponsored lying. Do you have any remedy how to fight it? I think I've asked you that before, but...
Yeah, this is a real problem. I think the main... So just to recap what I said in the book for your listeners, most people who have history in Russia or that part of the world will know the story of Katyn, where the Russians basically murdered many tens of thousands of Polish officers. And when the mass graves were then discovered, the Russians blamed it on the Nazis and continued institutionally at all levels blaming it on the Nazis, even though it was well known that the Russians had organized this atrocity. And they just, for many, many, many years, they did this, and it was only finally during the Yeltsin era when the files were opened that everybody discovered that this was the case. And this is what happened in the murder of Sergei Magnitsky, that up and down the line, the Russian authorities lied and lied and lied at every different level. Nobody seemed to have any shame about it. And I found it very disconcerting. And then all of a sudden we see them doing the same thing in Ukraine. Now, the one thing that makes it much harder to lie now than it was during the years after Katyn is that the Internet exists. And as long as the Internet exists, there's lots of information flying around about what's going on. And on top of the Internet existing, you have mobile phones with people taking pictures everywhere. And then you have satellite cameras taking pictures. And so the ability to credibly lie has been diminished a lot. Doesn't mean that the willingness to lie has diminished, and the Russian authorities continue to use this as their tool for disinformation. But I don't believe that it's all that effective a tool. I think everybody in the West understands what's going on, and I think that a lot of people in Russia understand what's going on, and this will be Putin's ultimate undoing, is that he can't use the old technologies in a new modern age.
Well, unfortunately, Russian propaganda, it's in every country, because almost every country where Russian immigrants have RT, Russia Channel 1, and they keep doing this state-sponsored lying.
Well, you know, I read a survey of opinions about the Russian authorities in different countries, The state-sponsored lying may work for people who only watch Russian television, and that may be true of people in Russia and émigrés outside of Russia, but it doesn't work on the rest of the world. And this survey that I read basically had roughly 80% of Americans, Canadians, Europeans thinking that Putin is a villain. And so whatever his attempts are to change the public opinion by lying haven't worked on public opinion. It may work on diplomacy, because Western politicians or Western heads of state don't want any fight with Russia, and they'd like to believe the lies so they don't have to engage Russia in the ultimate confrontation, which is what Putin is pushing towards. But at least from a public standpoint, nobody believes a word he says.
Let's go back for a second doing business in Russia. NDS returns, which is what Sergei Magnitsky was killed over, it was a big chunk of money, but we are talking about NDS returns. And everybody who had business in Russia knew that NDS returns was a corruption scheme. And some people consider it basically a cost of doing business in Russia. So simply, we are saying if you just paid this money, maybe nothing would have happened.
Well, no, I think that there's a confusion there. So what happened in the case of Sergei Magnitsky was that the Russian tax authorities, combined with the corrupt police, raided our offices, seized our companies, and then stole the taxes that we paid in a previous year. So this was not them stealing my money. This was a bunch of corrupt officials stealing money from the state that we had paid before. And this was a large amount of money. It was $230 million. And what we've discovered is that basically all the tax money that everybody paid was being stolen through these schemes.
Exactly.
And so, but it's not, this is not the cost of doing business. This is the cost of the Russian authorities robbing the Russian state. And so what happened to Sergei Magnitsky, and I don't think everybody assumed that this was correct, because most people have been pretty shocked even in Russia, when I tell the story of how all money from the Russian budget has been stolen. I think most people think that, you know, you can get ripped off if you're running your own business, but nobody assumes that all money that's being paid into the tax authorities gets stolen, or all money that should be used for building hospitals and schools should be stolen. I mean, it's just, you know, if you believe that and you still want to live in Russia after that, you have something wrong with you. And so I think that either, in the case of Sergei Magnitsky, he was young and idealistic and wanting a normal country. And, you know, a lot of people sort of look at that scorn, a lot of Russians look at that scornfully, like there's something wrong with being an idealist and wanting a normal country. But he paid the ultimate price. And I guarantee you when the Putin regime falls, they'll build monuments for Sergei Magnitsky, because that's the kind of Russian that Russia should honor, not desecrate.
Tell me something. I know lots of people who were squeezed out of Russia. We just live in the West, enjoying life, enjoying the money we have left, and not doing much about it. Why is your case different? Why Sergei Magnitsky's death changed you so much? But you basically devoted your whole life to fight for justice.
Well, because Sergei Magnitsky would still be alive today. He'd still be playing with his children. He'd still be a loving husband to his wife. He'd still be going to the conservatory, listening to the classical music he loved, if he hadn't been my lawyer. He was my lawyer. He was trying to protect me. And in that process, he was taken out of his middle-class life, where he bought his Starbucks coffee in the morning and sat in his cubicle in a nice office. He was taken out of that nice life and put into the worst dungeon in Moscow. And slowly, over a 358-day period, he was sadistically tortured and then killed at the age of 37. And I take responsibility for the fact that he'd be alive today if he hadn't worked for me. And the people who did this, killed him in the most horrible way. And I can't live with myself if I don't find some way to right that wrong. And if you watch these terrible videos on TV of these Westerners being killed by ISIS, everybody is affected by that. Well, imagine multiplying that by a million times, and that's how I've been affected by what they did to Sergei Magnitsky. It was very personal. It was directed towards me. He'd still be alive today, and I just can't let these people get away with it. It broke my heart. And so, I can't get on with my life. I have to make sure that the people who did this are punished.
There is one horrifying chapter in your book which I didn't know anything about, and it's a story about Yekaterina Mikheyeva, who was the wife of some Russian businessman, and people who killed the police officer who were responsible for Magnitsky's murder also kidnapped her husband. So it was like real mafia dealings. It wasn't one-off case with Magnitsky. It was very normal way of doing business, kidnapping people, extracting money from people. I was horrified. I didn't know about that.
Well, and the thing about it is that there's probably a lot of cases that we still don't know about that the same group of people were involved in, and that's what makes it so terrible. The poor Mikheyev family has suffered just fantastically, and they don't have the same resources that we do of publicizing their case and so on. And at least their case is known now, but there's many, many other cases that aren't. And the amount of heartbreak that goes on in Russia because of these cases, and I think it's just off the charts. And this story tells about some of it. The movie Leviathan tells another version of it. And anybody who's been in Russia knows these stories. It's just terrible. I mean, it's medieval what goes on over there.
Tell me, what do you think what's going to happen now? Because we have lots of Ukrainian listeners, and we are hoping the truth will hold, but nobody expecting Vladimir Putin to to keep his word. What do you think is going to happen now?
Well, I know how Vladimir Putin behaves in a conflict. I know how Russians generally behave in conflicts. Nobody ever backs down. Putin started this war. He had no reason to go to war with Ukraine. It's completely idiotic. The only reason he did this is because he is a large-scale kleptocrat. He saw that a much lesser kleptocrat, somebody who didn't have the capacity to steal as much, Yanukovych, was run out of his own country by his outraged people. And Putin was expecting that if he didn't create some enormous distraction, he'd be run out of his own country eventually. And so Putin started a war. I mean, it was completely, the Ukrainians have done nothing to provoke a war. It's just unbelievable. And so he started this war in order to distract the Russian people, and he also started a massive propaganda campaign, which you referred to before, which everybody, I'm sure, on this show knows about.
Yeah.
And so he's created this myth that Ukrainians are fascist Nazis backed by the West that are going to ethnically cleanse Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, which is just nonsensical beyond belief. But now that he's done this, he can't back down, because if he were to back down, then somebody more nationalistic than him would say, well, if he's not ready to protect our Russian brothers and sisters in Ukraine, then I'm going to, and that will be the end of Putin. And so Putin has no choice but to escalate, to stay in Ukraine and to take further territory. This is purely, and I've been involved in all sorts of conflicts with these people, but they lie, and they use these ceasefires and other types of misinformation as tactical ways of either allowing a bit of time to pass so they can get more equipment in or whatever it is, or they want there's too much of a momentum building towards sanctions or military or the agreement to send military equipment to the Ukrainians, so they want to do something to stop that. But Putin has no intention of backing down. He will not back down. This ceasefire is a nonsense as far as I'm concerned. I predict that within days there will be no more ceasefire. And the worst part of this whole story is that Putin can't just stop at Ukraine. He's got to keep everybody in a state of war in Russia, which means that eventually they're going to go back into Georgia, they'll go into Moldova, and then eventually, and I don't know when this is going to happen, and maybe sooner, maybe later, he's going to then start to test out whether the NATO treaty will really protect the Baltics. And that's obviously the most dangerous part of this whole thing from a global peace standpoint, because if he goes in, and then it challenges the West to whether the United States, the Canadians, the English, the Germans are ready to go to war with Russia over little countries that most people haven't heard of. And he believes that they probably won't, at least the current set of heads of state.
You know economic situation in Russia very well, I assume. So do you think the Russian economy will crumble, basically, in the next, few months, few years? And also, another economic question, do you think shareholders of Yukos have any chance of getting $50 billion back that European Tribunal ordered to pay back?
Well, those two questions are highly related, because to answer your first question, I believe that Russia is already in a major economic crisis. An enormous amount of the export revenues of the country and the budget revenues of the government and the income of Russian people is connected to oil, natural gas, and other commodities. And through a combination of, mainly because of oil prices going down, but then on top of that, the fact that you have Western sanctions making Russian companies unable to borrow money in the West, they have $650 billion of debt that they have to eventually refinance. In other words, they've got to go back and borrow more money, and there's no money in the West anymore, and there's no money in Russia anymore. The central bank has less than $400 billion of reserves, of which 200 are not liquid, and they're not going to spend their money on this, a lot of companies. So you're going to have bankruptcies, you're going to have the reserves of Russia being run down, you're eventually going to have capital controls and currency controls in Russia. Putin is going to get more and more desperate. He's going to then look for ways of getting more money. He's going to renationalize Russian companies. I expect that maybe some of his territorial ambitions will be to go after neighboring countries that have oil resources to get more money. So the answer is I don't think there's going to be any money left for the Yukos shareholders to seize from the Russian government, even if they wanted to, at the end of this whole thing, because Russia will be basically broke, which is a catastrophe for the people, but it may be the catalyst for Putin eventually being overthrown.
There is a judge in Magnitsky case who was already under sanctions, and now he's in charge of Nadezhda Savchenko trial. Do you think she has a chance of ever getting out because of these corrupt judges?
Well, there's no chance. The judge is not making any judgments. The judge is just taking orders, and so it all depends on. I mean, in a certain way, her campaign has made her more of a valuable hostage. She's a hostage. She's been taken hostage, and I think she has a great chance of getting out when there's some quid pro quo. There's some trade that the Russians want to do, but so far she's more valuable to them as a hostage than trading, and so. That her ultimate fate, if she doesn't succumb to her hunger strike in prison, is when she gets traded for some concession from the Ukrainians.
Perhaps Evgeny wanted to ask a question. No, it's okay. Bill, thank you very much, and I wish your book and you all the best. And hopefully. This will not be demise of Russia as a country, but it will be demise of Russian government and Vladimir Putin's corrupt kleptocratic government. We all We all wish it would happen sooner, but we'll see. With people like this, maybe it will.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we can only hope and pray that, because there's 140 million good Russians out there and a million very bad ones occupying the country, and the 140 million good ones don't deserve what's happening to them.
Thank you very much. All the best.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.